Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would just like to apologize. Because of the writer's strike, this class will be a repeat of of last week's class. I thought about opening my sermon this Shabbos with that. I'm sorry, I don't have any new material, so what am I going to do?
We'll laugh again.
Thank you. Marcy said we'll laugh again. What we have today is really a fascinating episode, and I have a lot of interesting stuff on it. But before I begin, I want you to know that although I don't yet have a date, I think it's going to be the beginning of December. Finally, I managed to get my act together and email Reuven Firestone, who is the scholar of Islam, the Jewish scholar of Islam who teaches at Hebrew Union College, and asked him if he would come and explain the Akedah to us from an Islamic point of view and the position of Yishmael and so on and how the Quran and the Bible differs. And he emailed me back, I think last night, and said he'd be delighted to. And he said that Thursday mornings actually worked with his schedule, so I will let you know when it is, and I think that it should be fascinating to listen to him. Remember that when I first contacted him, he was spending a year in Egypt studying, so he's now back, and should be a really interesting, even though we're past the Akedah, nonetheless, the question obviously is important, and I'm looking forward to learning about it too. Okay, now, chapter 24. I did learn something in the intervening week while studying more about this chapter. We talked last week about why it is that Abraham makes Eliezer, his servant, put his hand by his thigh when he swears, and we gave all the obvious answers. But one scholar says that he believes that it is a way of saying your offspring and mine also will have peace. Right? Because you, obviously it's suggestive of offspring to put your hand on a man's thigh. Okay, so now here is an interesting question that actually didn't even occur to me, although one of you I think brought it up last time, which is, why not the Canaanites? I mean, Abraham says to Eliezer specifically, I don't want you to take a bride from among the Canaanites where we live. And then he says to him, look what he says in verse 5, verse 4 rather, chapter 24, we're in chapter 24, verse 4. He says, but go to the land of my birth and get a wife for my son Isaac. Okay, moladati. He does not say, go to my family. Now it turns out, as we'll see, that Eliezer goes to his family or finds someone from his family. But he doesn't say, go to my family. So the question is, look, they're pagans in the land of his birth too, right? That's why he left. So why does he want Eliezer to go to those pagans? What's wrong with the pagans who live next door? They're equally pagan. It's not like the pagans, you know, back in where Abraham was born in Ur Kasdim are any less pagan. And several commentators give an answer. I'll give you two. And one I think is much better than the other. Shadal, but they're both reflective in some ways of the situation of the rabbis at the time. Shadal, who was an Italian rabbi, and Italy was, you know, Italy was not the worst place in the world for Jews, interestingly enough, in the Middle Ages. I mean, during the Inquisition, when you didn't want to live in Spain, the Jews were actually safe in Italy, even though that's where the Pope lived. So it's later on things became worse, but it's an interesting history. Anyway, Shadal says that the issue here is all about politics, that Abraham is afraid of the political implications of marrying into the people around him. What happens later when God's going to give him the land? What do you do when you're dispossessing your own family from the land next to you? So that's his view, which is kind of interesting and plausible, but not as good as Hirsch, Samson Raphael Hirsch of the 19th century Germany, who said the reason that Abraham, and this will give, remember that the most assimilated community that we know of before the modern United States was Germany, the Jews in Germany, right? Even more than Spain. So Hirsch said he doesn't want them to marry with the Canaanites because you're much more likely to assimilate with the culture around you. If you bring a foreigner from another land, that foreigner is going to assimilate to our family. But if you marry somebody next door, then there's going to be a constant, you know, whose house do you go to on Shabbat, right? Do you go to the Canaanite house? Do you go to the Jewish house? So he wanted someone far away, even if they were pagan, because once you bring them to a different culture, you have a much better chance of acculturating them. And after all, there were no Jews around. Whoever Isaac was going to marry was going to be pagan. So I think that Hirsch's answer is an interesting one, and it makes sense to me. But it is also fascinating to realize that there is no one for Abraham to match his son up with, who is part of the tradition that he's part of. And how it ends up that Eliezer finds Abraham's family back in Ur Kasdim, we'll come to in a second. Okay. So we read last time that Eliezer says, but what if the woman won't come back? And Abraham says, whatever you do, don't take my son back there, right? I came from there. I don't want my descendants to go back there. Verse 7, the Lord God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and my native land, who promised me on oath, saying, I'll assign this land to your offspring, he'll send an angel before you, and you'll get a wife for my son from there. And if the woman doesn't consent to follow you, then be clear of this oath with me, don't take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Master Abraham and swore to him as bidden. That's as far as we got last time. Now let's go on to what Eliezer actually does when he gets there. All right, everybody clear on the situation. Abraham says, go to the house of my brother. And these are the only instructions that Eliezer is given. Because what this chapter is all going to be about is what Eliezer does with the instructions he's given, and then what he says he did with the instructions he's given. And those are three separate stories that we will compare, okay? By the way, yes, I'm so glad I saw this before we moved on. Those are the last words that Abraham speaks in the Bible. The very last words, okay? Now, I want to take you back to the first words that Abraham speaks in the Bible just for a second, just to show how much he has grown. Verse 15, chapter 15, verse 2. Book of Genesis, chapter 15, verse 2. What are his first words in the Bible? What can you give me, O Lord, seeing that I shall die childless, and the one in charge of my household is Damesek Eliezer? And now what's happening with his last words, he's saying to Eliezer, go get a wife for my son. And God promised me this land. In other words, it's almost a reverse of everything he says in his first words are given to us. Now, he's going to do more things in the Bible, but we will never hear Abraham's voice again. Okay? And it's clear that he's traveled a road of increasing faith to the point where he not only believes God's promise for the land, but God's promise for offspring and a future. Okay. The one other thing that I want to say in a general framing term before we get to the specifics is that this chapter, this sedra, this portion of the biblical reading that is Chaye Sarah is about two things. It's about death and marriage, right? Sarah dies, Abraham gets married. And that's, in some ways, it's the whole of life in sort of one capsule. Remember, Abraham dies too, but he dies after he gets his son married off. And it's clear that Rebekah, it's explicit in the Torah and very much so in the rabbinic writings, Rebekah is a substitute. A substitute is not the right word, but takes the place of Sarah in terms of a surrogate, maybe. I want to say something nicer than a substitute. Sounds like a substitute teacher where you lie about what your name is in class, you know. Continuation maybe, partly a reflection. She's her own person. Though one of the things that's interesting about Rebecca is how, you know, there's an essay by Maurice Samuel, and I may actually read you a small piece of it, called Rebecca the Manager. Of all the matriarchs, if you want to know the one who manages to get her own way from the first moment, it's Rebecca. So in some ways, she's even more powerful than Sarah, although Sarah got her own way too, remember. She got Ishmael with Hagar, and then she kicked him out of the house, and she got Isaac to get the legacy. So the matriarchs are pretty formidable. All right, verse 10. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and set out, taking with him all the bounty of his master, and made his way to Aram Naharaim, to the city of Nahor. So he takes with him all this stuff. Why? Because if you're going to get a bride, the first thing you want to show them is how wealthy you are. And he's representing Abraham. So he's bringing lots of camels laden with stuff so that he can offer him rewards. He made the camels kneel down by the well of the city at evening time, at a time when the women came out to draw water. And he said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, grant me good fortune this day and deal graciously with my master Abraham. Here I stand by the spring as the daughters of the townsmen come out to draw water. Let the maiden to whom I say, please lower your jar that I may drink, and who replies, drink, and I will also water your camels, let her be the one whom you have decreed for your servant Isaac. Thereby shall I know you've dealt graciously with your master. Now, those of you who are here early on Shabbos morning, that is 10 o'clock when you have the teaching, know that there is a problem that is debated in this very passage. And if you want to know what the problem is, I will read to you from Maimonides, from Rambam, who writes in his Hilchot Avodah Zarah, which means laws of idolatry, one must not practice divination the way the idolaters do. As it says in Leviticus, you shall not practice divination. Divination means foretelling the future or looking for signs. You're not supposed to do that. What is meant by divination? Like those who say, since my bread fell from my mouth, or since my staff fell from my hand, I shall not go to such and such a place today. For if I go, my wish will not be done. He who sets a sign for himself, if such and such happens to me, I'll do so and so, and if it doesn't happen to me, I shall not do so and so, such as Abraham's servant Eliezer. This is forbidden, and whoever takes action on the basis of these things is to be punished. He actually says flogged, right? That's the, flogged means whipped. That's the biblical punishment for divination. Now, before you get too upset, I just want you to know there are other Jewish authorities who disagree with Maimonides, right? Ravad comes along and says, how dare he say that Eliezer was a bad guy. But the principle stands, which is most Jewish authorities think that divination is wrong. You're not allowed to say, if the lights go out during this class, then clearly God doesn't like the Torah class and we will never have the class again. Okay? You're not allowed to say that. Because God won't be coerced that way to provide signs. So there is a large literature about whether what Eliezer was doing was divination or not. And I just wanted to distinguish, though, between two kinds of divination. Some allow the kind, any kind. Others say that Eliezer's divination is permitted because it's the kind of divination that also bears on the subject itself. That is, actually, if someone comes out and acts kindly, then that's a sign that it's the right person. So, for example, an example that one commentator gives is you're not allowed to say, if I walk outside and the first thing I see is a deer, then I won't go on this trip. But you are allowed to say, if I walk outside and the sky is cloudy, I won't go on this trip. Because a cloudy sky also means rain, and it's a sign that also has some substance in the world, and that kind of divination is permitted. But something that's pure magic is not. Okay. So now let's talk for a second about the question of divination in general. And I have a lovely passage for you that I really hope I Xeroxed. Is this it? No, this is not it. One second. Yeah, did someone have their hand up while I'm looking for this?
Yeah, go ahead. Just gonna say that in reading this passage before, it never occurred to me that it was an act of divination. I thought it was kind of a biblical form of interviewing because of the reason that you said. It's a test, really, to see what type of person, what character.
Yeah. The tricky part of that is that you should do that after the person comes forth, and it can't just be one sentence, or it shouldn't just be one sentence, right? But Oh, I can't believe it. With all the papers that I did bring, I did not bring Malbim, unfortunately. Okay. Malbim, who is a classical commentator, gives four separate reasons why he agrees with you. That, in fact, it's not a form of divination, that it is his attempt to pick the kind of person, I just want to make sure I don't have it, to pick the kind of person that is likely to be a good wife for Isaac. All right, I don't have it, but if I remember it, then it seems relevant. I'll bring it next time. Having said that, now we can look at how what happened subsequently, and you'll get a sense of how this plays out. Okay. He had scarcely finished speaking when Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with a jar on her shoulder. The maiden was very beautiful. Now, actually, it doesn't say very beautiful. It says Tovat Mar'em Od, which means very nice looking, as opposed to Yifat Mar'eh, which some people think means very beautiful. And the reason I say that is that one commentator distinguishes between Rebecca and Sarah and Rachel. That Sarah and Rachel are called Yifat Mar'eh, and this is Tovat Mar'eh. And one commentator thinks that this is suggesting that Rebecca is not as beautiful as Sarah and Rachel. And his comment is because beauty in the Bible, great beauty, always spells trouble. Right? Remember, Sarah gets in trouble because, you know, passed off as wife to sister. Also, that happens to Rebecca too, but let's ignore that for a minute. And Rachel, obviously, it causes trouble with Leah, right? Rachel and Leah and the beauty. Yes. Divination.
Divination, because it's like assuming
omnipotence. Right. The reason that it's forbidden is there are two possibilities. Either there is a force in the world other than God, and you're appealing to that force, or the only force is God, and you're forcing God to do something. Right. Prayer is an ask. Prayer is a petition, but magic is forcing. If you make a certain spell and you say a certain thing, then magically things happen. So there are only two possibilities. Either you're appealing to something that's not God, or you're using a formula that God has to answer. And for those reasons, magic is frowned upon because it's not very monotheistic. Let me put it this way. Dualists, people who believe in two different powers, pagans, are very, very magical. Right? If you read Greek myths or whatever, there's always magic being practiced, and it makes sense because if you won't do what I want, so I'll do magic and make the other god do what I want. But if there's only one god, then you ought to just pray. Yeah.
So technically Rebecca and Isaac are first cousins?
Yes.
And the reason I ask that is because barrenness is so common in the Bible. Is it just scientific?
It's an interesting question. I don't know. The question was, if they're first cousins and there's so much inbreeding in the Bible, does that have anything to do with barrenness, which is common? My impression, and I'll have to ask my brother about this because he works in genetics, but my impression is that it's not that inbreeding, it's not a question of barrenness as much as it is a question of a greater incidence of some defect in offspring. But I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure. I think also barrenness in the Bible, I mean, look, it goes as far as Ruth, right? If you read the book of Ruth, which if you've never done, I strongly urge you to do. It's one of the most, I don't want to say entertaining. That makes it, but it is very entertaining and lovely and short, and it's a beautiful story. But it's all about fullness and emptiness. And I think there's a lot of that theme that runs through the entire Bible about fullness and emptiness, and it plays out in barrenness and promise. And I would guess that in part, it is the part of the motif of the ancient world. I mean, it is of the modern world too, but especially of the ancient world, where, you know, it's interesting, where children are so indispensable, not for emotional satisfaction alone, but for economic. You know, if you don't have someone to leave your lands to, which have been in your family for, then it's gone. Right, it's gone forever. Yes.
Can I go back to Eliezer?
Sure, please.
It always seemed to me that he was praying to his own God, but to the God of his master, but that the form he used would be the form that he would use to his own gods, whoever they were.
Right.
So that it wouldn't be divination, it would be just what he was accustomed to.
You may well be right. The rabbinic tradition doesn't see it that way because they assume that when it says earlier, Hanefashot Asher Asu B'Charan, all the souls they made in Haran, that Abraham and Sarah converted all of their household. So the rabbis assume that Eliezer believes what Abraham does. But you may well be right that that Eliezer has in him this vestige of the way that he was raised, and so he's praying the way that he was taught to pray, especially now that he's on his own.
Right.
He's been delegated this, and he says, I'll find it in the signs of a natural way that she comes and is nice, and it fits him so beautiful. And then later, the guys say, well, is it logic? Is it this? But it feels to me that if you don't take it separately, he's praying, and he's praying that he will know within the natural universe how
right.
to do his task.
Yes, I think that they feel that way too, but the question is the form of his prayer the form that his prayer should take, and some think yes and some think no. It's impossible as a reader to read a story and not bring your own world to it. You know?
What I'm saying is that the part of Judaism that bothers me the most is it's out when it goes out of Tao and it is not into using the natural, it's saying we're not people of the world, we're not, it's a movement into
okay.
the spiritual and the head and it's
all right. I will. I mean, this is a much longer discussion. You have Jews all across the board, right? You have Jews who are uncomfortable when Judaism doesn't become logical, and you have Jews who are uncomfortable when Judaism is rational and logical. I think that both of them are indispensable for a living tradition, but certainly everybody has the side that they, you know, that is closer to their heart. He'd scarcely finished speaking when Rebekah, who was born to Bituel, son of came out with a jar on her shoulder. The maiden was very beautiful, a virgin whom no man had known. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up. Okay, you got the scene, right? The servant ran toward her and said, please let me sip a little water from your jar. All he asked for is a little drink. What does she say? Drink, my lord, she said, and quickly lowered her jar upon her hand and let him drink. And when she had let him drink his fill, she said, I will also draw for your camels until they finish drinking. Quickly emptying her jar into the trough, she ran back to the well to draw and drew for all his camels. Okay, now let's just stop there. First of all, she does much more than he even asked for. Notice that she says, drink, and then she says, I will get water for your camels until they finish drinking. Now, 10 camels can drink a lot of water, right? Some 20 to 25 gallons apiece. This is not information that I have at my fingertips, but one of the commentators says this, right? It's not that I know how much camels drink. You can ask me any mammal, I'll tell you. But that's a lot of drawing water. And obviously, her response is not a response of divination, but clearly a response of extraordinary kindness. And now you have to figure out why. So let's give a couple of possibilities. I mean, it could be that this is just who Rebekah is. And anybody who comes along, you know, and asks her for help, she's right there. It also is it's a reversal of the usual scene. And I'll read you a little bit from Robert Alter in a second. Usually, remember what happens with Moshe? How does Moshe meet his wife? Anyone remember? He meets at the well. And not only does he meet her at the well, but some shepherds are harassing Tzipora and her sisters, and he chases the shepherds off and helps them get water. It's unique that the woman helps the man, right? Rebecca has an unusual strength. And remember, just in case all these stories get mixed up in your mind, it is Rebecca who's going to make sure that Jacob, her son, that she loves, I mean, they're both her sons, but that she loves, gets the birthright and not Esau. She's going to fool her old blind husband and manipulate her son to get him to get the birthright. And it's the same Rebecca who here spots, if you want to read it a little cynically, she says, here's a guy with 10 camels, right? They all look like they have something on their backs. And maybe she even thinks to herself, you know what? They doesn't look like the camels are his, right? Maybe she thinks they are his. Who knows? Maybe Eliezer, although he's been alive for a long time, I can't imagine that he, because she probably thinks he's not actually a candidate, so to speak, for marriage. Maybe has a good son. Exactly. I think that could very well be so. Doesn't hurt to be nice to people who have 10 camels. So, yes. Well, here's what I would say. I really think there's a sort of natural component, and then there's a cultural component. The natural component is that security, that women generally, I don't know actually how much of this is natural and how much of it is cultural, but from ancient times, let's put it that way, whether natural or cultural, women look to men for security and men look to women for beauty. That was the trade-off, right? You marry a beautiful woman and beauty was a commodity that you could trade for wealth, right? Men who had a beautiful daughter would try to get the beautiful daughter to marry a wealthy guy, right? Because beauty is a commodity. And you can go to Hollywood and you can come from poverty. And if you're beautiful, you go to Hollywood and you can be famous, you can be rich because beauty is a commodity. So in that sense, in just purely economic sense, they both have a commodity that the other wants, right? One has beauty, one has wealth. Now, human beings are much, much, much more complicated than that. So there are lots of other qualities, and beauty, by the way, is not purely a physical quality, right? Attractiveness and beauty are not identical. Someone can be very beautiful and not attractive. Somebody can be extremely attractive but objectively not beautiful. So I would say attractiveness is probably a better way to put it, and wealth isn't only wealth. Someone can be poor, but you can see in this person that they're going to do well, right? And I've married many couples, and the woman will say, I have faith that this guy is going to make it, right? I'm marrying him because I see he's ambitious, he's smart, he's talented, he's all those things. And so the thing gets complicated, and to say you should just look for someone with a Mercedes is to reduce it far beyond, because some people do when they're young, as you know. But to look for that in the other, that is, to look for that which will attract me in future years, or on the other hand, that which will be able to take care of me in future years, I would say if you had to pick one component that's the most powerful in people getting married, it's probably that on each side. Yeah. So, yeah.
Could the fact that it says that she looked nice be saying about her inner beauty that
could be.
She wasn't all that nice, but she looked nice?
But she was Tov Ma'od, right. Yeah, could be. Yes. Yeah. Well, it could well be. I mean, look, in the ancient world, men got married anytime after 13, and women got married anytime after 12, but they sometimes got betrothed much before that, 8, 9, usually not married, but betrothed. That's why you have a bar and bat mitzvah at that age, you know. I mean, you become a bar and bat mitzvah at the age, let's not kid ourselves, of puberty, when you can have children, and that's when people got married, right? Now, everything changed when lifespans got expanded and so on, and adolescence got invented, right, by the Industrial Revolution. There were no adolescents. People went to work. There was no such thing as adolescence. Now, I don't know if you read the David Brooks, right, yeah, the Odyssey years. He says now that, you know, people are living even longer and staying in jobs even longer, like from 21 to 30, 35, people are going on these odysseys of self-discovery, but this is all a function of the fact that things are getting longer. So yeah, I assume Rebecca was young. How young, I don't know, but young enough to water the camels. I mean, old enough. Yeah, but that's a rabbinic. The rabbis do that. Well, no, that's a rabbinic tradition. The rabbis do that not only with Rebecca, but with others too. But it's clear that she's not 3 years old, because a three-year-old couldn't water camels by herself or have this conversation. So, yeah. Well, Isaac was probably, right, Isaac was probably 40, around 40, if he was 37 at the Akedah, which also tells you at the time of the birthright that Rebecca was a much younger woman. Isaac is old and blind and, you know, and Rebecca is, what's 30 years between friends, you know? Remember, if that's true, the only other thing I'll say is, the rabbis say all the time, Ein mukdam u'muchar b'Torah. There is no early and late in the Torah. That we always assume that the stories follow in sequence, but they don't always follow in sequence. So the short answer is we don't know how old Isaac was and how old Rebecca was unless it explicitly says so. But vast differences in age are not unusual in traditional societies, as you know. There are lots of examples, but just to give one example, a famous example, when King David is dying, Avishag the Shunammite, right, is brought to his bed, and she's a young virgin, and he's a dying king, and she's brought there just to keep him warm. So, I mean, presumably she went on to marry somebody, but the idea of a much older man with a much younger woman was not strange to the ancient world. Yeah. Right.
I mean, they don't say Nara, they don't say Yamda, they say virgin, which means, you know.
Right, which suggests that she's, if you were 3 years old, you would not have to identify her as a virgin. I think that's fair, yeah. Okay, anyway, whatever age she was, she's old enough to get married.
That's my question. Yeah.
Oh, the significance of her being a virgin is that she is more, what's the nice way to put this? She's more valuable for marriage, right? A wealthy man does not want to marry in classical societies until, by the way, very modern times, does not want to marry somebody who's not a virgin, right? That's why even the ketubah, if you have been married before, the ketubah is different, and you get a lower bride price in the ketubah than if you haven't been married, at which point you assume that the person is a virgin, which is a kind, these days, obviously a legal fiction, but it used to be true, right? We live in a different world. Okay, and moving right along, let me just read you this. Let me read you this as soon as I'm. Robert Alter is a biblical scholar, and he teaches at Berkeley. He published his own translation of the Torah with commentary, and just published a book of Psalms. And this is what he says: Isaac is conspicuous by his absence from the scene. This is, in fact, the only instance where a surrogate, rather than the man himself, meets the girl at the well. This is in several pages about biblical, what he calls biblical type scenes. And one of the standard scenes of the Bible is husband meets wife at the well, right? They're not husband and wife yet, right? Right. Man meets woman at the well, and it goes on to husband and wife. As a complement to the absence of the bridegroom, it's only in this betrothal scene that the girl and not the stranger draws water from the well. Rebecca is to become the shrewdest and most potent of the matriarchs, so it's entirely appropriate that she should dominate her bridal scene, right? Because Isaac's nowhere to be seen. Isaac, on the other hand, is the most passive of the patriarchs, right? Isaac is the one who's always acted upon. Isaac doesn't do anything, right? Isaac's two claims to fame in the Bible, well, three. One is that when the Akedah came, he didn't protest, which is passive. The second is that he's the only one who never leaves the land of Israel, right? Which is passive. The third is that he redigs the wells that his father dug. But he doesn't do anything that shows the kind of stunning initiative that Abraham does, that Jacob does, that Joseph does. Isaac is the passive one. But the reason that he succeeds is because he didn't marry a passive woman. He marries the most dominating of the matriarchs, which, and I'm sure the marriage wouldn't work if somebody wasn't passive, right? Somebody's got to be passive in that house. You assume that Rebecca calls the shots, and that's in fact what happens. Because when it comes to the most important action that a man can do in the Bible, which is to pass his legacy on to his children, Rebecca decides, right? Isaac doesn't decide. Yeah. Maybe. That the addition of a hey or the absence of a hey in the Bible is very capricious.
But how come they're
repeating? I wouldn't assume they vocalize it as Na'ara. The absence of a hey doesn't usually mean something. You can make something of it if you want, but it's not unusual to add or to subtract a hey from the ending of a word that sometimes has it. Okay. So let's see. Let's continue now with this, and then I'll go on. Okay, where are we? We're at the well, exactly. The man then, meanwhile, stood gazing at her, silently wondering whether the Lord had made his errand successful or not. Because who knows, right? It looks good, but when the camp... By the way, you'll see all through this, there is an alteration in what Eliezer is called. Sometimes he's called the man, sometimes he's called the servant. And I went through a really interesting article. I have it here, but I'm not going to read you the whole thing, that tries to analyze when he is the man and when he is the servant. He says that he's the man when he's acting on his own or when he's seen by someone as a man. And right now you can see Rebecca seeing him as a man and not as a servant. Right? That's why he's called the man, because he's being seen through Rebecca's eyes. So if you think about that, as we go through this, you'll see if we that grid explains when he's called man and when he's called servant. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold nose ring weighing half a shekel and 2 gold bands for her arms, 10 shekels in weight. "Pray tell me," he said, "whose daughter are you? Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" She replied, "I'm the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." And she went on, "There's plenty of straw and feed at home, and also room to spend the night." Notice that he didn't ask if there was food. Right? She said, "We can take care of your camels." And I mean, this is a very astute, considerate, you know, and she clearly wants him to come. And by the way, notice that she was already paid for her service. He gave her gold. So maybe they were striking a bargain even without saying it, right? Maybe she knows that if she spends a couple hours, right, feeding his camels, that he's going to be more or less obligated.
Oh, so you're saying that he did not ask about spending the night?
No, he asked about spending the night. He doesn't ask about food. He says, "Is there room to spend the night?" And she says, "There's plenty of straw and feed and also room to spend the night." The man bowed low in homage to the Lord and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not withheld his steadfast faithfulness from my master, for I have been guided on my errand by the Lord to the house of my master's kinsman." So now he knows it was right. Now, it says the maiden ran and told all this to her mother's household. Did she tell them that he was from Abraham? Did he say the previous sentence in her hearing? Not clear, although it seems that way. Now, Rebecca had a brother whose name was Lavan. Lavan ran out to the man. He is still, in his eyes, a man. At the spring, when he saw the nose rings and the bands on his sister's arm, and when he heard his sister say, "Thus the man spoke to me." Now, already you get a hint of something about Lavan, right? When does he run out there? When he sees the gold. Right, exactly. Maybe I'll just go say hello to this guy, right? And remember that that Rebecca is Lavan's sister. So if you want to see Rebecca as somebody who knows exactly what's going on, there's every warrant to do so in the text. Yeah. That's probably true. Yep. That is probably exactly true. I assume that, although I don't know whether, I don't know why, unless it is that the father has died, which is also a possibility. Thus the man spoke to me. He went up to the man who was still standing beside the camels at the spring. Come in, O blessed of the Lord. Why do you remain outside when I've made ready the house and the place for the camels? So the man entered the house, and the camels were unloaded. The camels were given straw and feed, and the water was brought to bathe the feet and the feet of the men with him. But when the food was set before him, he said, I will not eat until I have told my tale. He said, speak then. And that's also, that's very fairy tale-ish, you know. First, I have a story to tell. Okay, you know what? Here's the thing, is the story that he tells is a long story, and then he reports back a long story. There are really three stories in one chapter. So let's just read through them. And then next time, because we don't have time this time, next time I'm going to give you out a sheet that writes in columns what happened and what he says. And you'll see that they're not exactly the same. And we're going to look at the differences between them, okay? I'm Abraham's servant, he says, but we can at least note a few things along the way. The Lord has greatly blessed my master, and he has become rich. Here, notice he identifies himself, obviously, as a servant. He's given him sheep and cattle, silver and gold, male and female slaves, camels and asses. And Sarah, my master's wife, bore my master a son in her old age, and he has assigned to him everything he owns. This is a really good way to start a conversation, right? Because they all know by now, you know, everybody knows what's coming. Now my master made me swear, saying, you shall not get a wife for my son from among the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I dwell, but you shall go to my father's house, which Abraham does not say. He says, go Moladiti, to the place where I was born. He doesn't say go to my father's house, right? But Eliezer, who's thinking to himself, you know, I had better let them know that we really want you, because that's the father's house, even though, as you pointed out before, it's called the mother's house. But he is gilding the lily, as the Shakespearean phrase has it, right? He's making it even more beautiful. It's not enough that it's a flower that's beautiful. He's going to put gold on the flower. To my father's house, to my kindred, and get a wife for my son. And I said to my master, what if the woman does not follow me? He replied to me, the Lord, whose ways I have followed, will send his angel with you and make your errand successful. That's not what Abraham said. What did Abraham say? He said, read the whole thing that Eliezer says. He will send an angel with you, make your errand successful. You'll get a wife for a son for my kindred, from my father's house. Thus only shall you be free from my adjuration. That's the vow. If, when you come to my kindred, they refuse you, only then shall you be freed from my adjuration. He doesn't say, the one thing he leaves out here is, and Abraham made me promise not to bring Isaac to the place where you guys live. For obvious reasons, that's insulting, right? He doesn't want to say, the one thing that I was told is, where you are, Isaac can never go, right? So instead he just says, he said, don't worry, he'll come back, and if he doesn't come back, then you've fulfilled your oath. She'll come back, rather. Okay? I came today to the spring, and as I said, we'll look at this in more detail, because what happened in the story are different, but I want to point out some along the way. And I said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, if you would indeed grant success to the errand on which I'm engaged, as I stand by the spring of water, let the young woman who comes out to draw, to whom I say, please let me drink a little water from your jar, and who answers, you may drink, and I will also draw for your camels, let her be the wife whom the Lord has decreed for my master's son. I had scarcely finished praying in my heart when Rebekah came out with a jar on her shoulder and went down to the spring and drew. And I said to her, please give me a drink. She quickly lowered her jar and said, drink, and I will also water your camels. So I drank, and she also watered the camels. I inquired of her, whose daughter are you? And she said, the daughter of Betuel, son of Nahor, whom Milcah bore to him. I put the ring on her nose and the bands on her arm. That's also not correct. He put the bands on her arm and the ring on her nose and then found out who she was. He rewarded her first, right? And we can talk about why that difference is in there. But there is clearly, and not only that, but as long as we're on the topic, here is the Bible that tells nothing about 3 days when Abraham and Isaac are walking to their slaughter, but can't seem to shut up about this little incident at the well. So you have to ask yourself also, why is the Bible expanding on this at such great length when the Bible never expands on anything at great length. Then I bowed low in homage to the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who led me in the right way to get the daughter of my master's brother for his son. And now, if you mean to treat my master with true kindness, tell me, or if not, tell me also, that I may turn right or left. And that's his whole speech, okay? Let's just look at the, we'll read through the result, and then next time we'll look at it more carefully. I don't want to keep you in suspense. Then Laban and Bethuel answered, "The matter was decreed by the Lord. We cannot speak to you, good or bad. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go. Let her be a wife to your master's son, as the Lord has spoken." When Abraham's servant heard their words, now he's the servant, right? Because he's just, here's for your master's son. He bowed low to ground before the Lord. The servant brought out objects of silver and gold and gave them to Rebekah and gave presents to her brother and her mother. He's now acting as Abraham's servant, so that's what he's called. Then he and the men with him ate and drank and spent the night. When they arose next morning, he said, "Give me leave to go to my master." But her brother and her mother said, "Let the maiden remain with us for some 10 days that you may go." All right, he says, "Let's go right away." They say, Let her stay for 10 days. You can imagine all the reasons why. You know, we have to say goodbye to the relatives, whatever it is. He said to them, "Do not delay me now that the Lord has made my errand successful. Give me leave that I may go to my master." And they said, "Let us call the girl and ask for her reply." So again, in the house of her elders, who makes the decisions about things? Rebekah, right? She's going to decide when to go. And here's what's interesting. They call Rebekah and say to her, "Will you go with this man?" They don't want to call him a servant now, because he just said to them, "I want to go now," right? So they recognize that he has some power too. They're not treating him as a servant at the moment. Not only that, but Rebekah so far has not seen him as a servant. Every time he looks through Rebekah's eyes, she sees him as a man, which may say something about Rebekah. And she said, "I will." Now, as one of the commentators points out, no young woman is ready at a moment's notice to leave. Which means, he said, that she must have been up all night getting herself ready, because her plan was to go. Because the moment they say, "Are you going to go with him now?" and she says, "I will," and then she goes, you got to assume that she was all packed, right? She didn't want to say goodbye to the relatives. She's eloping. So they sent off her sister Rebekah and her nurse along with Abraham's servant. Now notice, they're noticing, they see him as a servant. Right? They sent her off with Abraham's servant and men, and they blessed her and said, and this is what you say to a woman in her bedekin when you do the veiling right before the wedding, "Achotenu atihil alfei rivava," our sister, may you become myriads. It's a fertility blessing, right? "May your offspring seize the gates of their foes." Then Rebekah and her maids arose, mounted the camels, and followed the man. Now it's only Rebekah's looking at him, so she sees him as a man, right? But wait. So the servant, because now it's the narrator, took Rebekah and went on his way, because now he's fulfilling, and you'll see when she sees him as a servant. Isaac had just come back from the vicinity of Be'er Lahai Roi, for he was settled in the region of the Negev. And Isaac went out walking in the field the evening, and looking up, he saw camels approaching. Raising her eyes, Rebekah saw Isaac, already foreshadowing his blindness. He only sees a mass of camels. She spots him, right? She knows she's under no illusions about what's going on. She alighted from the camel and said to the servant, now, because now she sees his master. Once she sees Isaac, Eliezer goes back to being a servant. She says to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field toward us?" And the servant said, "That is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things he'd done. Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah and took Rebekah as his wife. Isaac loved her and found comfort after his mother's death. Those of you who are interested in the Oedipal complex, there you go, right? It's not just that he found a wife, but that he took her into his mother's tent and found comfort after his mother's death in his wife, okay? And also, by the way, this is the perpetual tension, right? I don't think that Rebekah and Sarah would coexist very easily. Right? Two extremely strong personalities, both of whom manipulate the men in their lives to get their way. And with only Abraham and Isaac in the house, I think there would have been a lot of clashes. And it works exactly right for Rebekah to come into the house as Sarah has left. So what we're going to look at next time, and then I'll take any questions on this, is the story itself, the elaboration of the story, and why it is so, why it's so so long. One second. That actually applies. I have a short passage to read, but it really applies to all the alterations in the story. So I think that I'll keep it. But it is clear that. One other thing that Leonard Cass says, this is really good. I put it, and I put a little check next to it to make sure I would read it. Remember I told you that Rebecca left, my instinct is Rebecca left because she wants to get out of that house as soon as possible, right? But he says something really good that I wanted to read you. Something more and of crucial importance. Instinct, by which I mean the totality of her character, right? What is instinct? It's all of you, right? You just feel this. Told Rebecca that it would be good for her husband to know and to remember for the rest of his life that when she was called to him, she turned to her family and said, I will go at once. Right? She's making a complete break. She didn't wait 10 days, right, to go to Isaac. The moment that she was asked, she left and she went. So there are a lot of subtleties in the story that are set the stage for the next part of the struggle, which is going to be the struggle between Jacob and Esau. And the struggle between Jacob and Esau is it in part plays out the tension between Rebekah and Isaac that Rebekah and Isaac don't get to play out between each other. You know, they both, you'll see when we come to Esau, Jung said that the greatest influence in the lives of children are the unlived lives of their parents. The things you don't get to do that you dream of, and your unfulfilled dreams influence your children, right? They have to play piano, because I wanted to play piano when I was a kid, and I never got the chance to have lessons, so my child is going to have piano lessons, right? My child doesn't have piano lessons because I did, right? Works both ways. But that idea, think of Isaac, the passive character, the person who doesn't control his life, and which kid does he love? Esau, right? The hunter, the man of action, the hairy man, the big man, the one who would never be strapped down on an altar to be sacrificed by his father, right? You can't do that to an Esau. You can do it to an Isaac, right? Isaac, little nebbishy Isaac, you can do it to, but not Esau. So the tension later on between Jacob and Esau is going to be in part the tension between Rebekah and Isaac. Rebekah, the woman who controls everything, which son is she going to gravitate to? The son who is part of her influence, right, who she can influence and who believes in the values that she believes in, right? But how she gets there and why Eliezer mistells his story and why the Bible tells his story at such length, that's what we're going to do next time before we get to, yeah.
Just going back to whether she's his first cousin or not, if she is born to Bethuel, who's the son of Abraham's brother, isn't Bethuel?
So whatever that makes her, right, a relative. Right. I don't know what's removed and what second cousins. Yes, you're right. She's not a first cousin. She is
first cousin once removed.
Thank you. That's what she is. Yes.
I have two quick questions. One is there significance to the fact that when they bring Rebecca back, he identifies Isaac as his master, whereas when he was with her family.
Yeah, I think that's exactly, it's a shift of generation, because he's really serving Isaac's interests there.
And then the other question is, it seems that throughout pagan characters will refer to the Lord. Laban calls
right.
Eliezer, he says, come, O blessed
right.
of the Lord. How do we recognize
Adoni and Adonai. Adoni is Lord and Adonai is Lord God. So you often refer to people as Lord in the ancient world. I don't think that it's intended as a religious reference. I think it's just on like now when you call someone a Lord, but it doesn't mean.
You're saying Lord. Come in, oh, blessed of the Lord.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I thought you meant who calls him Lord. There's an argument in the commentaries, classical and modern, about whether they believe in God or whether they're just aware of Abraham's belief in God. So they. I don't know. I actually can't answer that, except later on I do know that when when Lavan, there's later on there is evidence, we'll put it this way, that Lavan continues to be an idol worshiper because he wants his idols back when they're taken. So I would say it's either a conventional form of speech or he has some idea of what Abraham worships and figures that he wants to flatter him. Yeah.
One, it seems that Rebecca's leaving her father's house in parallel to Abraham leaving his father's house. They all both did it immediately.
That Rebecca's leaving is a parallel to Abraham leaving. Yeah, I think that that's true. It is a parallel. And they both leave from the same area of the world.
Right.
So, yeah.
And the second one is, I think that Abraham is telling Eliezer to go to his kindred. He's saying, well, I think this is the place where Abraham was born, in his father's house. He was still living in it at the time that God told him to.
Okay, but the only reason that I understand what you're saying, and you could certainly make that case. I just want to tell you why the people who don't make that case don't. It's that when Abraham is directed to leave, it says, Mimoladcha mi beit avicha. So since they divide it up, God divides it up, your birthplace, the house of your father, and Abraham only says to Eliezer, my birthplace, people are wondering why that he doesn't say the house of my father. Although you could answer that it's not the house of his father anymore. But he could say, you know, go to the house of my brother Nahor and to his family, and he doesn't. And Eliezer's going to the well and saying, whoever comes here and does this seems that he's open to more than just the house of Nahor, right? It seems like he's open to anyone in the community who turns out to be good. So, but it's not clear, I grant you. All right, great. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.